You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin drivers look pretty bad in a new survey on courtesy and driving. Do you buy it? We'll take your calls coming up.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news with a new offer on the table for transportation funding, a court ruling on a malpractice law, and more news on a possible Foxconn plant in Wisconsin.
Robert Mentzer joins us now from Wausau. He's storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
Let's start with that transportation budget. This has been a holdup for the state budget as a whole. That's about a week past due now. What is new from the governor on this?
Yeah, so, it's the same basic dynamic that has been what Republicans have been fighting about and disagreeing among themselves for the past year, the past couple of budget cycles. Essentially what is happening is some in the legislature, notably Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, say that road funding is so important and going into debt is so bad that the state ought to raise the gas tax or other revenue ways of ensuring that it's funding the state's roads. Governor Walker's position has been and still is raising taxes is bad. The state should not raise the gas tax. What it should do is bonding. It should borrow or scale back highway construction projects. That is the dispute. That is the same as it ever was argument. So on Thursday, Governor Walker came back with an offer that would reduce plans for borrowing by $200 million. From he had it at $500 million, would bring it down to $300 million. And then the other part of his plan involves a massive hike in what Wisconsin would ask the federal government to give Wisconsin for road money.
And that last point is what people have been pointing toward, including, again, other Republicans pointing toward with some skepticism. How big a jump would that be in the money Wisconsin would be expecting to get from the federal government on roads?
Oh, it's not small. So he would ask, the state's going to ask the Federal Department of Transportation for $341 million. That is about 10 times what Wisconsin requested last year. If you look at it, the average over time, it's not quite that pronounced. It's more like three times the amount of the average. But that's a big jump. And, it's also far from a sure thing that Wisconsin would even get this much money from the feds. So there's a little bit of either fuzzy math or at least a bit of a leap of faith in this proposal.
So what's been the response from lawmakers, especially those Assembly Republicans who are on the other side of the governor and saying we need some kind of revenue increase?
So they weren't crazy about it. I think that it appears that the impasse continues. This offer from the governor did not it doesn't look like it has the shape of a compromise that's going to end this thing. Although I guess this is how it works, right? They seem like they're miles apart until the moment when they're not. But the essential dynamic is unchanged, and I'm not in the betting business, so I don't know what will happen to break that impasse. But I mean, this is the whole ball game. Is it bad? Is it worse to raise taxes or is it worse to borrow?
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin about some of the top stories in state news. A state appeals court ruled this week, Rob, that Wisconsin's cap on medical malpractice is unconstitutional. Can you tell us about the case that led to this?
Yes. So in this specific case, a Milwaukee woman had a strep throat infection, the same type of infection that leads to strep throat. It was undiagnosed, and she had septic shock. Her organs shut down. She ended up losing all four of her limbs, both of her arms, both of her legs, as a result of this misdiagnosis or this the fact that this was missed. The jury in that case found that the doctor as well as a physician's assistant were liable. They should have given a different diagnosis. They should have given her options to seek other treatment. and awarded, awarded many millions of dollars in damages, which immediately was appealed because Wisconsin's law for decades is that there's a cap of $750,000 on the amount that you can get for pain and suffering damages in medical malpractice cases.
So this court said, no, now that cap is unconstitutional. So what is the next step then for this case?
So this is a federal appeals court. They ruled unanimously that it's unconstitutional on its face. The decision made an interesting point, which is that as designed, the cap only ever affects those victims who are most severely injured. So for somebody who doesn't have much pain and suffering, they can get the full amount of their damages. There's no limit if what you're claiming is that you had $50,000 pain and suffering. Where there is a limit is if a jury determines that your case is quite severe and what was done to you is so dramatic. So they argue in the decision that this doesn't seem right. And so this is why the cap is thrown out. Now it will be appealed. This is a federal appeals court. It would not be shocking to see this end up at the U.S. Supreme Court level. And it really does have shockwaves for Wisconsin's system. This has been in place in Wisconsin for so long that it really has shaped what the kind of legal environment is in Wisconsin. Wisconsin has more regulations on lawsuits than many other places, and that does prevent, you know, people see it as a good thing, or at least it does have some benefit in preventing, a very litigious environment in Wisconsin, and a lot of type different lawsuits, some of which may be frivolous. There are fewer of those in Wisconsin because it's simply there are limits on how much money a lawyer can make on this. What there also are is limits on what a legitimate victim can receive, and so that's what in appeals will be determined whether there can be a limit at all or what it ought to be.
And moving on, there's an update in the story of maybe a big employer looking at moving to Wisconsin, the technology company Foxconn. What is the latest this week on that?
Yeah, so the very latest is for the first time we had official confirmation from Wisconsin lawmakers, several now, that indeed Foxconn, this Taiwanese technology manufacturing company, is looking at Wisconsin as the site of this multi-billion-dollar facility that in a memo sent by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said could end up employing as many as 10,000 people. And the company is apparently considering southeastern Wisconsin for the plan. It looks like maybe Racine County might be the recipient.
And it looks like there's some kind of behind the scenes getting ready for this possibility.
Yeah, indeed. So the local Racine Economic Development agencies have been at work on this and granted some unusual leeway. None of these details are public yet, but it looks like they are at work on this project. And just today, just this afternoon, House Speaker Paul Ryan at a public event confirmed that he had met with Foxconn representatives about this deal. Also, as we try to narrow things down, the Janesville Gazette also reported today that it's not Janesville. That Foxconn looked at Janesville and is no longer looking at it. But it seems like it's still a live possibility, though. The reporting says that the company is also looking at Michigan. So, who knows? We'll see.
And in that memo from Robin Voss, he mentioned this Foxconn thing in the context of, hey, the funding for I-94 North-South through Racine and Kenosha counties continues to be delayed. So bringing it on home, he's using this to sell his transportation funding hopes and dreams.
It all comes back to the road funding. Yeah, I mean, if you have 10,000 people who need to get to work, or like trucks and stuff that need to get in and out of a giant electronics manufacturer, yeah, I guess you gotta have roads for that. So
before I let you go, Rob, I want to stay on the roads for a minute. In just a few minutes, we're going to ask our listeners to call about this survey that says Wisconsin driving. We're rude drivers. We're not very courteous. We're in the bottom five. What do you think about that? Do you buy that?
I mean, it's got to be all the potholes, right? It puts us in a lousy mood, right? What else? What other explanation is there? No, I don't know. I want to know about the methodology of this study, Rob. We need to dig into this. I don't believe it for a second. Have you ever been to Illinois?
Well, you sound like you're kind of a rude driver yourself, Rob.
I'm
just messing with you. Thanks, as always, for joining us, Rob. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He is based in Wausau.
If there's one thing Wisconsinites love after the Packers and cheese and beer, I guess, it's trash-talking drivers from Illinois. It turns out that we might have it wrong.
A new survey from Cars for Kids finds that Wisconsin drivers are among the rudest in the nation. Cars for Kids surveyed 50 drivers in each state and asked them about driving behaviors like stealing parking spaces, speeding up or slowing down to let someone pass, and making space to let people merge. When all is said and done, Wisconsin places 46th in the nation on the courtesy scale. That is behind our neighbors in Illinois.
And we want to know what you think about this at 800-642-1234. Do you agree or disagree? Are Wisconsin drivers really that rude? Do you speed up to stop people from passing? Do you steal parking spaces? Or do you try to kind of muscle in there to keep people from merging? Or are you kind of the nice guy or gal on the block? Well, let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lisa on Facebook wrote that she agrees wholeheartedly that we're rude, but she says it hasn't always been this way. Used to be in Wisconsin. Lisa says you were among friends, like the slogan went. People drove accordingly, not so much anymore, Lisa says. So she sees not only rudeness, but change over time. We're getting worse.
And Jason on Facebook says, I moved here from L.A. In my experience, L.A. drivers are very contentious of pedestrians, but don't give a whoop about bicyclists. Contentious.
Conscientious?
I wonder if he means conscientious.
Yeah,
that's my guess here. Here in Madison, I find it's the opposite.
And we heard from Jan on Facebook, I think Wisconsin drivers don't know that the left lane is the passing lane. That is often a point of contention. Can you just drive slowly in the left lane? No, I think is generally the accepted answer, but it doesn't always work out that way. And that is where a lot of the rudeness and conflict seems to come up on the highways. But in Wisconsin only? No, I think that happens just about everywhere.
Good. You saved by a call. I was about to tell people what a scary driver you were
that's
a couple of times.
That's really true. And you're welcome for the ride.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that ride. Let's go to Les in Beloit. Les, hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. How about you?
Not too bad. We used to live here in Beloit, so we know what the area is like. And your drivers don't nearly compare to what ours are back in Arizona, where we're living now. And people, they cut you off. They go off in the off-ramps and they'll swerve three or four lanes in front of you to get to an off-ramp. We have road rage out there constantly.
Knee-first syndrome.
We have drivers going down the freeway the back wrong way.
Wow.
They're killing people.
That is really bad, Les. And it was interesting that you brought up Arizona because actually Lisa on Facebook, the part that we didn't read, she talked about how awful the driving was in Phoenix.
Phoenix, right.
So there's another strike against Arizona. Interesting.
So, Wisconsin, better than Arizona, the new state slogan. We'll go next to Ben on the line in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi. I don't know about compared to other states, but I do know that over the years, the traffic patterns on the multi-lane highways like the interstates have gotten to the point where the vast majority of automobile traffic is in the left lane, leaving the right lane for semis with long stretches of empty road between the semis because people in the left lane will not move over to the right and yield to the traffic behind them, even though they're not moving any faster than the trucks in the right lane. That creates a lot of congestion and a lot of aggravation.
Ben, thanks a lot for the call. And do you, I don't know, do you feel ill-inclined or like being rude to the people slowing down in the left lane there?
Well, I always try to yield to people behind me that want to go faster than I do, and I try to move over into the right lane, even though that means that when I come up behind a semi, I have to wait to get back in the left lane. And it is aggravating, and I do get irritated, but I try to control myself and not do anything too stupid.
Good for you, Ben. Thanks a lot for calling and sharing that. I think that is probably a common complaint. We're talking, taking your calls now about this new survey. I wouldn't necessarily call it a super scientific survey, but a survey of people in each state rating rudeness and courtesy. Wisconsin comes out not looking so good when it comes to courtesy on the roads.
That's right. We're going to go to Dwayne next in Russ County. Dwayne, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to share?
I totally agree with it. I'm a truck driver, and I can't count the number of times in one day that I have a driver pull out in front of me to the point where I have to slow way down. And I drive Highway 51 a lot. Illinois drivers are, I mean, compared to Wisconsin drivers, they're extremely fast. They like their speed. But they're way more courteous than Wisconsin drivers. I don't think there's any doubt.
Wow, that's interesting. So you cross state lines a lot. Do you know if Wisconsin drivers have a bad reputation in Illinois, the way Illinois drivers do here?
You know what? I don't know that. I don't hear too much about that. I don't travel in Illinois very often.
Mm-hmm. Sure, but your vote is for Illinois drivers a little bit more courteous than Wisconsin drivers. So I think we might have to maybe take a look in the mirror on this one. Dwayne, thanks a lot for that perspective. Appreciate it.
And we'll go next to Auntie in Beaver Dam. Hi.
Hi, this is Angie.
Angie.
I think that Wisconsin drivers are really rude and don't follow the rules. I am from Wisconsin. But I went on a 6-week road trip with my kids last summer on the western part of the United States. And the left lane is strictly for passing. People don't drive slowly in it like they do here and zoom around you. There are a lot more safety signs. In large cities like Seattle, it seemed that they drove slowly and safely. And here, it's pretty crazy.
Huh. So it seems like this is a trend, Angie. Everybody thinks for better. I thought it was like in the state constitution that we had to feel superior to Illinois. I mean, but you feel pretty confident about this.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Angie, and sharing that story. Man, this left lane has a lot of people worked up.
Apparently this is a thing.
I'm not even going to go in the left lane anymore.
You know, the pedestrian angle is interesting too, because I do feel like when we went to Maine a few summers ago, they were really deadly serious, so it's a bad word in the scenario, but about the crosswalks, if there was a pedestrian who was even hovering near a crosswalk, sometimes a cop would emerge and shout at the car and hold up their hand. And so people really took seriously that you yield to pedestrians. And here I have to say in Madison, if I have one critique, that's mine. It's not the left lane. It's that people don't yield to pedestrians.
I've seen that around the state, too. Yeah, it does very much seem like stopping is sort of at your discretion, not legally, but in practice,
people
treat it as if you're feeling it.
But actually, it's kind of right of a way thing, right?
All right. Well, thanks a lot for the call, Angie. We'll go next to Bob in Fond du Lac. Bob, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. See, I have to say the indecisiveness of Wisconsin drivers is what differentiates them from Illinois.
Hmm.
In Illinois, if people are getting on an on-ramp, they're accelerating. In Wisconsin, if you're behind somebody, you got to make sure he's not hitting the brakes. Because you have to look over your shoulder to get on. But Wisconsinites will more often than not slow down on on-ramps. They're indecisive, and they turn out to be tailgaters. I've lived in both states for about 10 years equally, and I'd have to say Wisconsin drivers are generally more indecisive than Illinois drivers.
Bob, thanks a lot for that call. This is blowing my mind.
Yeah.
This is like, when we do toll road shows now, and people in Wisconsin say they kind of like toll roads. I assumed that we'd be getting overwhelming numbers of calls arguing with this survey. But no.
The times are changing.
I guess.
Yeah, we have some work to do. Doug is next in Kenosha County. Doug, hi.
Hey. Yeah, I disagree with your last people.
Uh-huh.
I live in Kenosha County, just a couple miles from the line, and I work in Illinois, so 80% of my time is driving in Illinois. And they're just as bad as anything I see in Wisconsin. I go to Milwaukee, go to Racine, go to Madison. They're no better than we are. I don't know who did this study, but we're not as bad. we're no worse than the Illinois people. Tailgating, cutting off, all that kind of stuff. It's the same.
No worse, but are we better?
No. I wouldn't say we're better.
You're not going to go that far.
I'm not going that far.
All right. Well, you're sticking up for us in some counts there, Doug. Thanks for that call.
Robert is with us next in Waukesha County. Robert, hi.
Hi. I don't think we can generalize that the state of Wisconsin has poorer or better drivers, because it's area by area. And I can say that because I lived in Waukesha County, and 20-some years ago I moved to Madison, and I couldn't believe how polite the drivers were in Madison. And I moved to Madison. I've now moved back to Waukesha County, and there's a clear difference. Madison is courteous. They don't tailgate for the most part. They put on their directional when they're changing lanes. I find absolutely none of that in Waukesha County.
Interesting, Robert. Thank you so much for that call. I do find Madison driving sometimes puzzling, I guess, more than rude and discourteous. But there are variations, I guess, around the state, too.
Robert, thanks for that. And a quick call now here from Jim in Menominee. Jim, hi.
Hi. I don't agree with anybody that's called in so far. And I drive between Minneapolis, Northern Illinois, Upper Michigan every day. So maybe it's just me that I'm a very courteous driver. I stay out of that left lane and let people in, and, you know. And I'm just thinking of what we see, like this guy that just said about Waukesha County. It's people that used to live in Illinois that now live here.
Oh, I like the way you think, Jim. That works for me. Jim, thanks a lot for that thought as we talk about driving here in Wisconsin. New study finding that Wisconsin drivers are the fifth rudest in the nation. So thanks a lot for sharing your thoughts on that. And, of course, always be safe out there. Remember, you can keep this conversation going way in over on the Central Time Facebook page. The most well-known superheroes in American pop culture have mostly been men. When it comes to saving the day, female heroes have been few and far between.
But turn on Netflix or consider the last few years' biggest blockbusters, and it seems like girls and women are less likely to be damsels in distress or less competent sidekicks. Now, more and more young girls are starring as action stars in mainstream movies and TV. Take a listen.
I'm her. The woman who saved the plane.
I would love to be upstairs watching TV or gossiping about boys or, God, even studying. But I have to save the world. Again.
You didn't stand your ground. You didn't fight.
Because there was no chance of changing his mind.
This is Ares, and he's not going to allow a negotiation or a surrender. The millions of people you talked about, they will die.
Primrose Everdeen.
Prim! Prim! I volunteer! I volunteer! I volunteer as tribute.
A Supergirl, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Wonder Woman, and The Hunger Games.
Spring Duval joins us now to look at female superheroes in pop culture. She is an assistant professor of communication at Salem College. Spring, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So when did we start to see this shift of girls taking on these roles of the hero?
Well, it's interesting you played the clip of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, because in a way we were having some similar conversations in the 90s about these action star girls filling television and film, and a real emphasis on being more physically aggressive. But really we've seen quite a bit of shift around the Hunger Games and in more recent years as new franchises have developed these strong female characters, and then existing franchises like Star Wars have begun casting the women and girls as the lead protagonist.
And before that, I mean, you said there were some examples in the 90s. I remember Buffy, too, but it seemed like what was so unusual was because she was a girl, and that was sort of almost the whole conceit in the beginning before the show took off. But what was it like for women who were watching these shows, superhero movies and things like that? What were the roles for women then?
You mean in the 90s?
Yeah, in the 90s and leading up to where we are now.
Well, we saw these characters begin to take on more action roles, again, more physically aggressive. And yes, that was the hook, the sort of novelty that girls and women could be violent, which was typically associated with men and boys. But we did see that many of those characters, and Buffy included, they were still very much conforming to beauty norms. They tended to be slender. They tended to be white. They tended to dress almost like fashion plates. And so they were being aggressive, but they were doing it in high heels and full makeup. And so there was still a very limited depiction of them. And often we would also see them in those time periods relegated to the sort of sidekick role.
And what about today? Where do we see women taking off and taking on some of these new roles? We talked about a couple of them, but which ones are you especially impressed with?
Well, some of the ones I've been watching, as I said, and taking notice of, are the casting for the new Star Wars films, the latest Star Wars films. The new Wonder Woman film has been really challenging the idea of comic book heroes, which has been, in terms of summer blockbuster films, really dominated by the traditional male characters. And so for Wonder Woman to privilege that female character that has existed for quite some time and has been appealing to women and girls for a long time, now to have the big budget, high production value, large release has been very significant. And then we can look at a shift also in animation away from the typical princess to a more nuanced lead female character as well, when we look at Moana, for example, as a departure from the past princess movies that have been so typical.
Let's talk about Wonder Woman for a second. Do you consider that movie a win? You mentioned some good things about it, but on the other hand, she was also barely wearing anything, had a lot of makeup on, looked like a supermodel while she was doing it. So what is the message there?
I do think that it's a lot of pressure to put on one film to expect it to be completely without problem. So in many ways, it is going to conform to the genre in terms of the way that she looks, the character that she was in the comic books, the way that she's been depicted in films and her iconic outfit and those sorts of things. But there was quite a lot of emphasis in that film on female physical power, but also inner strength. There was quite a bit to the narrative about vulnerability, the power of love. And so in terms of building a more nuanced character, yes, she was somewhat stereotypical physically, but she does push boundaries for what we expect to see with a woman in a comic book film. And again, as the lead character rather than a sidekick or a side character, she opens up those doors for more nuanced and more complicated depictions, hopefully, in the future. So in terms of a win, as a film overall, it has its problems, but it certainly has been important as a boundary breaker in terms of not just Wonder Woman as a lead character in a major film, but in terms of featuring a female director as well.
We're talking right now to Spring Duval, assistant professor of communication at Salem College, looking at how girls are increasingly becoming the heroes in film and on TV. And what do you think it does for girls growing up and also for women to see women and in some cases girls in these leading types of roles, including action roles?
Well, for a very long time, girls have had a fairly limited visibility in media. And so to be able to see themselves in the hero role provides girls with more variety in their role models. They are able to look at these powerful women and girls and everything from Hunger Games, again, to Wonder Woman, and see someone that they might aspire to be like, or that reflects them better than the typical boy hero might. We can see that this, just the visibility alone can be empowering, but then we can see how it might normalize the idea that, well, girls are complicated. They can be powerful. They can be very capable. It also validates that audiences have been really clamoring for these depictions for a very long time, and girls and women have quite a bit of purchasing power. So recognizing that this is what girls and women, many girls and women, are wanting to see, and then that they are, you know, sort of speaking with their money and buying movie tickets, watching television, and buying merchandise and so on.
And what about boys? What do you think boys growing up and men get when they see women in these roles? Does it help move the perception of what women can be?
I think it does. There is some evidence that children can be impacted by gender role stereotypes in media. And so while boys have been able to consume television and film and see representations of boys and men, much greater variety, they can see themselves in those depictions, they've typically been seeing girls as sidekicks or as sex objects, very sexy depictions. And so boys can see more nuanced girl characters as well, or see girls in those roles, and it can open up more possibility of seeing girls as, again, capable, as powerful in their own right, and not just existing to be looked at or to be sidekicks. And in fact, what's really interesting to me when I look at some programs, if we look at something like the television program Stranger Things, with the girl protagonist Eleven being a very powerful and nuanced character, but the cast of boys who are interacting with her are also fairly diverse and very interesting, very unique characters. And so I think sometimes if we see these girls cast in more diverse roles, we can also see that in the rest of the content reflected in more interesting roles for boys as well.
Mm. What did you think of the Ghostbusters remake starring all women in those roles that were typically, you know, those big name comedians, Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd? It also, it seemed to me, busted another stereotype, which wasn't just the action part of it, but that women can be funny, that women are funny.
Yes, it's gotten so much attention lately, and it's really something that started, I think, to shift a little where that question of whether women are funny is sort of being put to bed. But we saw that with Bridesmaids before Ghostbusters, and I think that what was interesting there was the backlash against Ghostbusters as having been one of those franchises that was so iconic and so important for people, and to then make that gender shift seemed to cause quite a controversy. But what it does is, again, it shows that women and girls can and should be in a diverse range of roles, from comedies to action to drama and so on, where we've seen in the past typically boys and men in a great variety and diversity of genres and productions. So there was sort of something that boys and men could look to regardless of their taste. But for women and girls to be able to also, again, have that choice of genre, of style, in those high production value films and television, really gives girls and women more options and validates that they are a powerful segment of the audience.
We're talking right now with Spring Duvall from Salem College, and we're looking at how girls and women are increasingly becoming heroes in film and on TV.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you see girls and women being cast as action heroes in stories more? Is there a female hero that inspired you as a kid, or maybe your kids today, or you today for that matter? Do you look for more representation of heroes, female heroes, in books, TV, and movies? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation with Spring Duvall, Assistant Professor of Communication at Salem College. And we're talking about TV movies increasingly casting girls and women as heroes.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you look for shows or movies that feature girls as heroes in the action genre in particular? Do you have a favorite? Was there one that inspired you from past or present? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's go to our first caller now. We've got Paul joining us in Chippewa Falls. Paul, hi.
Hi. I wanted to call about how Ghostbusters, it had mostly women. It had an all-women cast, but if it was cast with all men for the second coming of, I don't think a lot of people would have gone to see it. And I was wondering if some, you know, producers promote these all-women casts to try to get more people to view them. Thank you.
Paul, thanks for that. And do you see anything, I don't know, he's not quite using this word, but anything gimmicky about using an all-women cast in Ghostbusters and women in other places? Is it a novelty or is this a cultural shift?
Well, in a sense, we can see reboots and reboots of franchises as gimmicky, as trying to take a franchise with a built-in audience and make more money off of it. So that happens with many franchises, comic books franchises, Star Wars, Star Trek. And so when studios have these franchises, they own the rights to, they own the script to, there's money to be made very often by revamping or rebooting those in some kind of fresh and appealing way. And so there is that motivation, that notion of, well, we could make more money off of this franchise if we reboot it or revamp it in some way, and then what's the novel way we could revamp it? But it's not gimmicky or just a novelty to try to appeal to women and girls as an audience segment, because again, there is money to be made off of women and girls as audience members, as ticket purchasers. We know that movies that feature female protagonists and movies that are directed by women are very profitable. So recognizing that actually makes good business sense. It's not a one-off. It does seem to be a shift on the production side to recognize it makes business sense to produce these films and television shows and market to women and girls because they are such a powerful segment of the purchasing population. But then there is a cultural shift because we can situate this in a larger context where we're seeing discussions about diversity in Hollywood in terms of race and ethnicity, discussions about pay equity in Hollywood for women and girls. So all of these other broader aspects contribute to a greater diversity on screen.
Thanks a lot for that call, Paul. We appreciate it. And we're going to go next to Margaret in Madison. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to talk about Xena Warrior Princess.
Ah, yeah. What did you want to say?
I have two daughters that grew up in the 90s, and boy, Xena Warrior Princess was a huge presence in our household. And it led to all kinds of creative play, creative costume making, making weapons, if you want to call them such, out of cardboard boxes, out of anything that they could find. My older daughter, she and her first boyfriend, I came home once and they were choreographing a stage fight in the backyard with lances. And what I liked most about that is that not so much that it empowered women, but it just made gender roles seem a little bit obsolete because Xena was so great and she fought for good and stuck up for the little person. But, you know, she didn't always fight against men. Sometimes she's against women, evil presences. And I was just really happy that my daughters got to grow up with that.
Margaret, thanks a lot.
It could have been a little bit of a cheesy show. It was wonderful in so many ways.
Margaret, thank you for sharing that. And Margaret's story there, a testament spring to the influence that a TV show can have on the way we think creatively and maybe also the way we think about gender.
Oh, absolutely. And the 90s were quite important for me growing up or coming of age. And actually this fall I'm fortunate enough to be teaching a class that's going to take a deep dive into 90s girl media and culture. Hmm. And Xena was an absolutely important cultural moment in terms of this depiction of this woman, but how inspiring, again, and how important it is for girls to be able to turn on a screen and see a character that can be a role model for them, that they can emulate and be inspired by and, you know, maybe not hurt each other if they're sisters and making weapons. But what it does is, to the point about making gender seem obsolete, what we begin to grapple with is the fact that in many ways these good versus evil hero tales can be genderless or gender neutral. They can be, those roles can be performed by men or women, boys or girls. We don't necessarily need to categorize them. They can become more universal.
Do you think that, are you seeing women of color getting in on this renaissance for women's roles, or is it still an imbalance toward white women?
There is still an imbalance, and we see that, again, as I mentioned, with the discussions around diversity in Hollywood, around the controversy of hashtag #OscarsSoWhite, that there is much work to be done in terms of racial diversity, ethnicity, and so forth. There was just another controversy around pay equity in terms of race. Yes, Hawaii Five-0, the two stars, two of the stars of that show. So there is absolutely improvements to be made in terms of race and ethnicity, and that is something that doesn't need to be obscured when we're talking about gender. You make an excellent point.
So things are changing, and we're hearing about it and seeing it on screens, big and small. What do you think the blue sky is here? What would you like to see when maybe we've completed a turn toward gender equity in film and entertainment?
So really the goal, not to put us both out of business, but the goal is that we wouldn't be having this conversation, that it would be so normalized and so common to see greater diversity in terms of women and girls, in terms of race and ethnicity, and so on, that we don't have to talk about it as being a novelty, as being a new trend. And so hopefully as we see these films and television become incredibly successful, a huge blockbuster for Wonder Woman, very profitable franchise for Hunger Games, Stranger Things being award-winning, and so on. Hopefully, as it makes more and more business sense, studios will continue in this direction because audiences flock to diverse representations, and we've seen audiences really clamor for this, and now that they're getting what they've wanted, we're seeing it become more successful.
Well, Spring, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Spring Duval, Assistant Professor of Communication at Salem College, with us there to talk about the shift toward girls as heroes in stories on TV and in film.